Hi everyone, and welcome to the Private Market Show brought to you by Let's Venture and Money Control. Here we talk about the nuances of investing into India's private markets, where the underlying asset is actually innovative technology, new markets, and good old enterprise. Investing in private markets is actually about investing in startups, and this can take many manifestations, all of which we will uncover and deep dive into our show. I'm your host, Shanti Mohan, co-founder and CEO of Let's Venture. Let's Venture was founded in 2013 with the vision of making early stage investing easy for both founders and investors. On the show today, we have Mohit Satyanand, chairman and founder at Teamworks, which now produces several of India's most prestigious art festivals, including the Jaipur Lit Festival. Mohit is also an active private market investor and is known for working with founders to scale businesses.
You have to respect the founder. So if you respect the founder, I think you can be a good investor. So from that respect, I think flows, firstly, non-interference. So, you know, as a lead investor, you are not a boss, you are not a spouse. You have certain fiduciary roles, you have the same roles as a board member.
On that note, let's get into the conversation with Mohit on angel investing. You know, I have known Mohit for the last probably 6 to 7 years and have seen him work very closely with founders. It's an absolute pleasure to host you on this show, Mohit.
My pleasure, Shanti. Let's Venture has been a very integral part of my journey as an angel investor.
I just wanted to start the podcast with asking you to give a little bit brief background about yourself and how you started on angel investing, because I know that you have a very, very, very rich background and that rich experience shows up when you work with founders. So it will be great for the listeners to know about a little bit more about you.
We have an expression in Hindi which says, you know, bade papad bele hain, which means you've done very many things. So very briefly, I started my career as a management trainee with Hindustan Lever after graduating from Delhi School of Economics way back in the late 70s. I then started a snack food business as an intrapreneur before that term was ever invented, and ended up creating India's first successful packaged snack food, which, like many other businesses, is now part of the new world, where it's owned by an American PE fund that was called Crax. I then decided, when I left Crax, I decided to get into a slightly more creative part of the world. And so for 7 or 8 years, I made documentary films. I worked with musicians. I worked with street children, set up a project that works with street kids, which now is the Salaam Balak Trust, which has 7 homes for street kids. And in the process, created another business, which was called Teamwork, which now is in the performing arts and, among other things, runs the Jaipur Literature Festival, which is considered the Kumbh of literary events around the world. Unfortunately, it's been a sleeping Kumbhkaran for the last year and a half because of COVID, but it'll come back to life next year, hopefully. I don't run the business any longer. It's run by my partner. From 2003 to 2015, I was very active in public markets, and not just as an investor, but also as a researcher and journalist. So I was consulting editor to Outlook Money and ran the equity side of that magazine. So that gave me all the understanding of the financial tools and what you look for in listed companies, etc. And there's a direct connection between my experience of public markets and private markets, which is very simply that in 2014, I realized that the nature of capital markets was changing, particularly with respect to new businesses. And I realized that with the coming of startup capital, micro VCs, VCs, PE firms, that by and large, new sectors of the economy would not be funded through public capital. They would be funded through private capital. And so looking 20, 30 years down the line, I would have two choices. One would be that my portfolio of listed companies would be a very old portfolio. It would only reflect old world companies. The second is that I would then buy new age companies at very high valuations. By the time they came through IPO, they would be so highly priced, there would be little upside for me. And so purely from a portfolio diversification point of view, I decided that I need to understand this domain of startup capital, seed funding, angel investing, whatever you want to call it.
So it's so interesting, Mohit, that you say this, because you know my recommendation as Let's Venture to a lot of investors is, if you are an active public market investor, I think it is not an option not to invest into private markets anymore, right?
It isn't.
How did the transition happen for you? And what would be your advice to somebody who's investing into public markets?
So, you know, I think each one has a different journey. And the role that I play today in the startup space is very different from what I envisaged. I came to it in the same way that one goes to public markets, which is that you represent an infinitesimal amount of capital. You don't change anything in terms of what happens in that business. And you have virtually an impact-free entry and exit into a publicly listed and traded company. That's not true in the private markets, you know. And it's certainly not true for me, because I ended up, by a whole constellation of circumstances, I ended up being a much more active investor than I envisaged. I think the way to look at it from a public market perspective is as follows. A lot of people enter the public markets from a single point of view, which is that if I look at the long term, in the long term, the Nifty, for example, has given a return of 11 or 12% per annum. Inflation is 5 or 6%. Therefore, my real return on capital is 7%. And therefore, even if I just invest in the Nifty, my capital is going to grow. And if I'm looking at retirement, then it's going to provide me that nest egg. So I think that's the top-down way in which you look at investing in public markets. And then you decide, depending on what kind of investor you are, you decide whether you want to just invest in an index or a PMS, or you actually want to get into active stock picking. But I think the starting point is that, which is that over a sufficient period of time, I'm going to get a positive real return on my capital. And it would be a very foolhardy public markets investor who would say, in order for me to get this kind of return, let me invest in one or two or three companies. You know, that would be really foolish. So the analogy with private markets is exactly the same, which is that over a longish period, now, the history of private markets in India is still fairly small, fairly short. It's probably 8 or 10 years. But over a sufficient period of time, the positive return in private markets is higher. It's reflecting a higher risk premium, and it is higher than that in public markets. It's very early for me with a six-year-old portfolio. Or rather, to be accurate, with a portfolio that is at maximum 6 years old, because I only started in early 2015, to talk about return or an IRR, but it is significantly higher than either my historical return in public markets or the Nifty. If I were to toss a safe number out there, I'd say that if on average the Nifty makes 11 or 12%, an active investor like me in public markets has, over the long run, made closer to 17-18%. I would say that in private markets, one is looking at well over 20%. As I said, this is not a number which a CA can put a stamp on, because exits so far have been few. But I think there are two or three common points and there are 2-3 differences. The first common point is that you need to have a portfolio. You can't invest in one company or 2 companies or 3 companies. If this is true of public markets, it's even more true of early stage investing, because there is a power distribution in private market investing, which is that you're more likely to have 1 or 2 companies which make 25, 50, 100x if you are a seed or an angel investor than you are if you are a public market investor. You are also much more likely to have 1 or 2 companies which go to zero. That does not often happen in public markets. It can happen, but it does not often happen. So the distribution is it's a much longer tail distribution. You have more zeros, but you also have many more companies with many zeros at the end. You know, 1 or 2 zeros is very, very common. So you need to diversify your portfolio. Second, just as it's true that day traders don't make money in public markets, people who want to make money in 2 or 3 or 4 years in private markets can't make it. There are no easy exits. And when I got in, I thought I was looking at a 5-year sort of time horizon. Having been in the market for 6 years, an exit in 5 years is not very common. I think a 7 to 8 year time horizon is the minimum. So those are the common factors between the two. The one significantly different factor is that you can't enter into as a seed investor. Obviously, you can't do it on a daily basis. You can't pick up the newspaper or the Zerodha terminal and say, okay, today I will buy such and such company. And you can't exit either. So that has to modulate your behavior. And I think you need to have separate buckets for the two. And when it comes to private markets, you need to have a much more patient outlook, a much longer term horizon for exits. That cannot be money that you need anytime in the next 5 or 7 years.
No, absolutely. So Mohit, while you have talked about the differences between public and private markets more from the return perspective, and having known you, right, you are someone who actually does not look at return as the first motivation when you invest into startups, because I have seen you work very closely with founders. So please talk to us about what do you find exciting about startups, and you know, how did that first investment feel like? How did you make that first investment when you invested into a startup?
How I made the first investment and how I make investments now is very different, Shanti. So I figured that, you know, at least the first 5 or 10 investments that I make are going to be my cost of learning. And I don't know the space. I don't know the channels of generating leads. I mean, I didn't even know this word of, you know, deal flow. But let me just write checks. Let me just start writing checks. And unlike public markets, where one can take a research-led view, which is that you can, you know, there's so much data out there. You can do any amount of backtesting. You can try any number of hypotheses. And you can spend several years doing research before you make your first investment. In private markets, that option is not open to you. I came at it with the perspective that, you know, there's going to be a cost of learning, and that cost of learning is going to be writing checks. And so I took a very, very mota-mota approach, which is I said, I'm going to write, over a period of 2 years, I'm going to write 20 checks of 5 lakhs each, invest a crore rupees, and see what happens. And in the initial stages, literally anything that came my way, where the founder didn't seem like duffer or a fraud, I said, okay, let me put my money into this. Let me see what happens. And it's actually... luck must have been smiling, you know, because the first 2 checks that I wrote, Shanti, the first one, I was very late into that particular investment. And there were a group of friends who made a couple of angel investments, and I just tagged along with them. And I'm still working with that company today. When I wrote that investment, I was the smallest and latest investor. But about a year, year and a half down the line, the company ran into trouble. The 2 founders were quarreling, and the group of investors decided, since I was the oldest number of years on this planet, that I should step in and become investor board member. And I ended up solving the problems between the two. And I'm still working with them. And, you know, my money and that of the other investors has now multiplied several X. The second one happened very differently, which is that I was speaking at a conference about Ayurveda and the prospects of creating an internet business out of Ayurveda. And at the end of it, this very quiet young man came up to me and said, "That was very interesting. I'd like to come and meet you sometime." He came and met me at home once, twice, third time he came with two or three of his team members, asked me to mentor him. I did. I asked them to completely realign their business, to shut down 6 out of the 7 verticals, focus on one. They then said it would require more investment. And that's how I met Let's Venture, because we brought the business onto Let's Venture. First time in my life, I heard the term lead investor. I became the lead investor. The company, as you probably know, is the Ayurveda Experience. We raised 4 crores on the Let's Venture platform at a 26 crore pre-money valuation. That company is now valued in excess of 600 crores. And I remain extremely close to the founder and sit on the board along with two VCs who've invested with it. And they too are happy because they invested 100 crores. So that journey taught me an enormous amount about what it means to be a lead investor. Told me that there's a platform, that's how I met you guys, and that's been... So it's been a series of happy accidents. There was no method to it except, let me jump right in and start writing checks. Now, of course, you know, the whole ecosystem has evolved so much. There are other platforms out there. The role of the lead investor has got more crystallized.
Yes.
And as is true with all journeys, Shanti, just as this very successful journey as a lead investor helped to crystallize the role, I don't know whether you remember, but there was also one accident, an unfortunate accident, at the end of which you and I and a couple of other people sat down and said, here's a case where a lead investor has failed completely.
Yes.
And that helped us again crystallize and define the role of a lead investor. And that was where suddenly one day, all of us investors got a phone call and the two co-founders were on the line and the lead investor. And they said, the purpose of this call is to tell you that the business has ceased operations. I couldn't believe it. I just couldn't believe that this was being delivered to us as a done deal.
Yes.
And that as investors, nobody had rung a warning bell saying, you know, there's a problem over here. Can somebody help? Can more money be funneled in? Can somebody help with re-strategizing? Done deal. That taught me so much about what a lead investor should not be.
Yes.
Versus what a lead investor should be. So it's been, as I said, a series of accidents, nice ones, bad ones, but it's been a fascinating journey to where the ecosystem is now. You know, together, you and all the other lead investors and syndicate leads and we've all, I think, played our little roles in helping to understand how this ecosystem should evolve, what a lead investor should do. And along the way, I think the whole ecosystem has developed a lot of momentum. And each of us then acquire, within that tiny little microcosm of the world, each of us acquire little stories tagged onto us. And then those stories create new realities. So the fact that I've been involved with a few successful startups also means that I get a lot of traffic from at very, very, very early stages from founders who just have so far already have their either their own funds or a little bit of family, and they're a long way even from raising their first outside check. Over the last couple of years, that journey that I had with the Ayurveda Experience is something which is getting repeated of young people coming to me and not asking for a check, you know, not looking to raise angel money, saying, look, this is where we are in our business. And we think that we could do with somebody who's willing to listen to a brand new story, help us shape our vision, and perhaps down the line, help us raise funds or not, it doesn't matter. That's a long answer to your question.
Oh, absolutely. Very, very interesting response. So Mohit, when you started, is that, you know, the way you evaluated companies when you started angel investing was very different from how you evaluate them today, right? And the first 2 years was more of cost of learning. And today you probably look at that asset class differently, right? So for somebody, and today we all know that the market is flushed with liquidity, right? There is a lot more speed required in decision-making for investors. So as an investor who's probably starting out today, what are the probably top 2-3 parameters we should look at when we start investing into companies?
So, you know, I have to say, Shanti, that, you know, the average investor starting out is probably not going to be looking at the space in the same way that I look at it today. Because the lesson that I've learned is that what really works for me is to enter very early and to play an active role.
Yes.
And that comes, you know, from the fact that I don't have a full-time job. This is one of the major things that I do. I'm a certain age. I have that experience of working as an entrepreneur, et cetera, et cetera. And therefore, the way in which I approach the markets is not going to be representative of the way in which most people who are beginning in the startup space do. I would say at this stage of where the business is, I think I would start with what you said, which is that markets are very, very flush with liquidity. And I think public markets are very overpriced. And I think that there is a very high risk that a lot of businesses which are coming onto into the private markets are also overpriced. It's bound to be because they both reflect the same situation, which is global liquidity flows, number one. And number two, very, very low returns in conventional asset classes like fixed deposits, bank deposits, real estate, et cetera, et cetera. So just from a liquidity point of view, the conditions are likely to be the same in both. These always ended up being very bad times in which to start investing, because they're usually followed by 3 or 4 years of very suboptimal returns. I think one has to be very careful in such times not to get carried away by popular sentiment that this sector is hot, let me invest over here. Don't follow the crowd.
So don't follow momentum play, right?
Don't follow momentum play.
Yes.
There's no hurry to make investments, you know. Life is long. This asset class is going to be here for a very, very long time. And I'll come back to that. From a macro point of view, I think at this stage, for people who are entering this space, it probably makes a lot of sense to firstly start by investing in sectors where you bring some domain knowledge.
Yes.
May be a little, it may be deep, it may be general, but try and find some edge to get into this business. You know, bring some domain knowledge in, number one. Number two, remember what I started off by saying, which is the power distribution. Therefore, keep your powder dry. Make small investments. Make sure that you can invest in whatever that number is, 5, 10, not more than 10, maybe 5 startups a year for the next 2-3 years, so that you are distributed across a large number of companies and over time, so that any distortions that there are in terms of pricing at a particular point in time, and avoid concentration risk. Obviously, as is true with any field of enterprise, read, learn, listen to calls. A platform like Let's Venture will give you access to a large number of founder calls. Listen to those calls. Listen to those calls. Track what happened to those investments in terms of, you know, what kind of people subscribed to them, how successful they were. Unfortunately, it's a little bit difficult to track the progress of those companies after they've been invested in, because they are private. But perhaps, you know, Shanti, this is something that you guys could perhaps think about, which is how to create more data for investors to look at the performance of companies which have come into the private markets in the rearview mirror, just as I can with public markets.
Yes.
Without violating the fact that they're private and so on and so forth, how can one create more data, give people more certainty about investing in this space? So I think these are the three things. Start with domain knowledge. Make sure that you have enough dry powder for 2 or 3 years, and expose yourself as much to what's happening in that space. And there's a lot more being written and said and podcasted about it than there was 6 years ago. So I think you'll be in a much happier place than I was 6 years ago.
No, absolutely. So I think that point about diversity of time, right, where, you know, you don't try to go make all your investments in the next 3 months, right, because you just got excited about the asset class. You have to learn to say no. You have to try to let go of some of those deals, right? Mm. And you don't know, right? I think investing on FOMO is probably the worst behavior you can start with when you're an angel investor.
FOMO is your worst enemy, absolutely.
Yes. So, Mohit, we also talked about the good lead investor and the bad lead investor, right? Can we just, at a high level, and I know, you know, you are a very different kind of lead investor where you spend a lot of time. You actually spend a lot of time before you even decide to invest, right? You really work with your founders. You sit on the board of the companies. And I think the fact that you say that I'm doing it because I'm not working full time, I think that can be kept aside, because I think it's more the intent of ensuring that you're committed to your founders when you sit on the board of those companies. Can we talk a little bit more about, you know, who is a good lead investor? What should you not do as a lead investor? And, you know, as a investor who is backing a lead investor, what should I watch out for?
So for me, the key word, Shanti, is respect, which is that you have to respect the founder. So if you respect the founder, I think you can be a good lead investor. So from that respect, I think flows, firstly, non-interference. So, you know, as a lead investor, you are not a boss. You are not a spouse. You have certain fiduciary roles. You have the same roles as a board member. But beyond that, because these are startups, you need to create a situation of continual access. You need to encourage the founder to be able to reach out to you, not just for those reviews and those board meetings and anything that requires you to sign off, but you need to develop a relationship where the founder actually enjoys talking to you, you know? So it's not like, oh God, I'm answerable to this person. Because that can get very tiring for both people. But more of, look, I'm here. It's for you to figure out what value I can bring to the table and then to draw upon that value. And once you've established that and communicated that, then in order to fulfill that role, then that means that you must be easy to access.
Yes.
You must be willing to respond to WhatsApp messages. If there's a document that needs studying and needs your response, you must be willing to go through it carefully. It's not your job to get into the nitty-gritty and look at numbers in a detailed manner and so on and so forth. But like any board member, try and get the big picture in. If there's one new thing that I've learned over the last 3 or 4 years, you know, one of the things that happens when you sit on a board of a large or an old or an established listed companies, that 99% of your work happens in the boardroom and with the CEO. But I think when you're dealing with a startup and the whole team is also new, and there are a lot of initiatives being driven at the head of department level, I think what I've learned is that it's very valuable to get to know the second rung as well. To in some ways also, because, you know, founders can be very pressured, they can be very impatient, and typically there can be periods where there's a lot of friction between either two founders or the founders and the team that immediately reports to them. And understanding those people, understanding the relationships between them is something that is an investment which is well made, because you can intercede sometimes and sort out turf wars or differences of perception that may be emerging. So I find it very useful in review meetings to get to know people who head functions inside the company as well. Thirdly, which is a slightly different but very, very contiguous space to respect, is also humility. Because these are founders are incredibly passionate, incredibly ambitious, incredibly dynamic businessmen. They are smarter, more ambitious, much faster than business founders were 30 or 40 years ago when I was their age and doing the same kind of thing as them. They have much more exposure. They have much more tools at their disposal, whether on the funding side or the data side or third parties who can help them with marketing, compliance, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. We tended to have to build all of these functions in-house. So as a result, they can move much faster. They acquire knowledge much, much faster. And typically, you know nothing compared to these people. You know nothing compared to them. So you have to go into every meeting saying to yourself, I'm going to learn a lot today. And so I must be open to that learning. You must walk out from that meeting thinking, I've learned something today. And that learning is only going to come if you're going to be open and you're going to be humble. I think that it's about, in every 3 meetings, you learn so much, but there may be 1 meeting out of 3 where you give back something significant. That's worth it. You can have 3 or 4 or 5 meetings where you've really contributed nothing. You're just listening. But I think it's where you can contribute is in terms of the structure of that meeting to make sure that all the relevant data is coming out. There's not data heavy, but insight heavy. Just the fact of that meeting and forcing people to think through stuff before they present to you or to the board if there's more than one outside director is in itself half the job done. It's incredibly enriching. And if you're going to be open and you're going to be humble, you're not going to go there with an attitude of, I need to say something important today, because often there's nothing you need to say. They're on the right track and you just need to be there to listen. If you go in with those attitudes, then I think you're contributing more than you realize. But I think there are 2 other things, Shanti, which are from the perspective of that role as a lead investor. The first is that, you know, most of the time, your role is vis-a-vis the business and the founder and his team, but you're also a representative of the investors. And from that perspective, I think you have a very important function. The first is that you must be able to plant a red flag when there's trouble. You should be one of the first people attending those meetings to be able to say, oh, trouble ahead. That's where your experience can play a role. Whether that's in terms of funding, or that's in terms of the quality of employees, or that's in terms of competition, or a strategic mismatch, or whatever, that's where you can play a really big role as a lead investor. Raise the flag early. And not necessarily the moment you see that flag, at some point in time where you think it's going to require some major realignment, then rallying the other investors around. And that is often required only perhaps when either you've not been able to find, along with the team, the answer to that problem. You know, we've run into a cul-de-sac in terms of strategy or competitive forces or whatever it is. We can't find an answer. That's perhaps the time to pick up the phone and speak to a few other co-investors. But if it requires a significant injection of capital, and there's been a lot more of that over the last 15 or 16 months because of COVID and the disruptions that it's caused, then it's never too early to jump in and say, we need to raise capital. And the first step there, very obviously, is to speak to your co-investors. And I think this, this is something that I saw very early, as I said, that first accident that we had 4 or 5 years ago, that this is a key role that you've got to play. And I think that lesson stood me in very good stead over the last 8 or 10 months, where we've had to raise fresh rounds of capital for several companies that I've been involved with. Sometimes you have to push the founder. There's for some people, not all of them, there's a sort of a shame in the fact that you know, our business has not grown, but we have to raise more money. You have to be the one to push them. Often they see it earlier than you, but if they don't, or there's some sort of reticence to go out and do it, you know, maybe we'll tide over the next 6 weeks. Maybe this will happen. It doesn't make sure that they've got enough cushion beneath them, and reach out to the other investors very fast.
This is almost like a masterclass for lead investors, right? Because, you know, very beautifully articulated in terms of, I think that what I like the most is the element of respect, right? I think it's very, very important. So in my mind, it is about creating a safe space for founders where they can come and talk to you without the fear of being judged, whether they are a good founder, whether they are a bad founder, whether the business is a failure or a success. I think today it's so much required for founders, right? Because building a company is very difficult.
Very difficult.
You're able to find a lead investor who is your friend, who is your mentor, advisor, sounding board. I think it will become a beautiful relationship for both sides.
It is such a beautiful relationship, Shanti. It is such a beautiful, I can't tell you the nuances of the relationships that I've developed over these years, you know, with at least 5 or 6 founders, you know, where I know them, I know their spouses, I know their offspring, I know their parents, you know, I know their hobbies, we do things together. And I think that phrase that you used is a lovely phrase, a safe space.
Yes.
I think those conversations should be very safe, very hallowed spaces, of very careful consideration between the two.
Yeah, so that leads me to my, you know, final question, Mohit. Just what have you learned in your own personal experience of having been so closely associated with startups and been a lead investor? What has been your own personal learnings in life?
Firstly, deepening of what we just talked about, which is of respect for other human beings.
Yes.
You know, we grew up in a very hierarchical world, Shanti. 40, when I started working 45 years ago, the world was very, very hierarchical. Respect only flowed in one direction, you know, it only flowed upward. That that gradient was defined by seniority, title, and typically age. And society too was hierarchical, not just the workspace.
Yes.
And so, you know, the lesson that I've learned in life, but very deeply accelerated over the last 6 years, is that you need to show respect to everybody, because everybody is bringing something to the table, and especially to founders. Because what you put in is a small check. Typically, angels put in an amount which, if it went to naught tomorrow, would make no difference to them. zero difference. You know, because as a financial advisor, you tell investors, create a small allocation of your overall net worth for seed investing. Out of that, split it over 20 companies. So each individual check is meaningless to you. But the founder is giving 3, 4, 5, 7, 10 years of their life to that business. So you have to have tremendous respect for that amount of energy and passion that they're giving to the business. And this is, as I said, for me, coming from somebody who's typically, most of the founders that I work with, their parents are younger than I am. So it's a profound lesson to have respect for people who are so much younger than you. The second, which is related, is that, you know, just as I grew up in a hierarchical world, my first 20 years of doing business and most everything that I did was the people I worked with came from a very narrow slice of India. They all had gone to prestigious schools and colleges in Delhi, you know. They went to St. Columbus School or St. Xavier School or Modern School. They went to St. Stephen's College or Shriram School. They went to either Delhi School of Economics or IIT or IIMs. And those are all the people that you knew. And they were all the same age as you, you know, plus or minus 5 years. Today, I work with founders who come from Dhanbad and Agra and Tundla, and of course, Delhi and Pune and Chandigarh and Lucknow. Some of them come from very, very humble backgrounds. But they all have so much to teach you. So I can say with all honesty that I'm learning more about the world every month at age 65 than I was learning at age 25. So that's, I think, the second lesson, very strongly affiliated to the third, to the first. And the third lesson, and I think this would be true of any investor in startups, not just of being a lead investor and an advisor, is patience. Because, you know, if you're a public investor, not only can you, but typically most of you are able to say every morning what your net worth is, you know, and this is how much this share went up by, and this is how much this went down by, and so on and so forth. If you're an investor in private markets, you can't put a value to your investment sometimes for a few years, you know, so especially for the first 2 or 3 years, there's no value because there's no exits, there's no matter. So you have to develop a very, very, very patient attitude towards investments in the private space.
Well, thank you so much, Mohit, for giving us the time. I would say that this episode is not as much about just the aspects of angel investing, but the life lessons angel investors learn when they start working with companies and with founders. And, you know, a very different aspect of angel investing, right? Which really teaches you as you grow as a person, you know, where you put money to play because you're learning a lot more than what books and colleges can give you back, and real life experiences about working with founders.
Certainly true for me, Shanti. Absolutely.
Oh, no. Thank you so much for your time.
My pleasure, Shanti.
That's it on the episode of the Private Market Show. If you have a suggestion or feedback, please write to us at mcpodcast@nw18.com. We will be back next week with yet another insightful episode. Have a good week.